Can I hitch a ride to the liquor store? Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast looking down a sniper's scope at films where helicopters explode. Now, it'd be easy to assume that Hollywood is the natural home of the exploding helicopter, and certainly Tinseltown filmmakers have sent an impressively large number of helicopters to that great landing pad in the sky. But as we've tried to show on this podcast, helicopter explosions are very much an international cinema phenomena. On past shows, we've looked at chopper fireballs in Indian masala movies, Japanese anime, Hong Kong martial arts movies, and Ugandan action films. And our globe-trotting hunt for films with helicopter explosions continues on this show as we cast our eye on a Scandinavian entry in our favourite invented film genre. So, on this episode, we're looking at the Swedish cop thriller Man on the Roof. To help me review the film, I'm joined by two men who couldn't be more Swedish than Volvo, ABBA, or a set of impossible-to-understand IKEA assembly instructions. With me today are Jonas and Anders from the Pod Hard podcast. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you so much. So my name is Jonas. I'm the one half of Pod Hard.
And I'm Anders, the other one.
Well, it is a pleasure to have you both on the show because I'm a big fan of the Pod Hard podcast, where you've been doing a terrific series at the moment where you're looking at the origins of action cinema, and you've gone all the way back, well, all the way back to the 19th century even. And, you know, at the moment, though, you've worked your way through to the 1920s. So, yeah, I wondered what, you know, I wondered if you could sort of tell me, you know, what kind of what prompted you to spend all your time, you know, going back to the going back so far into history.
Well, there's a lot of different reasons, really. I mean, we've been doing our podcast in Swedish for quite some years now, and we felt that we should try to capture the international audience and go for English speaking. And whilst in the same time, we thought maybe we should get some kind of gimmick, as well as exploding helicopters would be your thing. So we thought, why not do something that we're both very interested in, tracing the roots of action cinema? And that is not really something I think that nobody else has been tried to do, at least in podcast form. So we thought, why not? We'll learn something along the way.
And how do you think some of the stunts and, you know, action scenes you've seen in these films, you know, how do you think they, you know, compare to what we see in films today? And yeah, maybe throw that one to Anders first.
So far, I think we've been surprised at how early some action tropes were developed, as early as the 1900s. and through to 1910s. So far we haven't seen more complex choreography in fight scenes, but there are more the haywire variety. But there has been some impressive fight scenes and takedowns and even wrestling and grappling and stuff. And blowing up stuff, they are great at an early early stage, I think. Yeah. Blowing up buildings and stuff. So there's not that much difference, I would say.
Well, absolutely. I've been quite impressed with the early movies, especially when we're getting into the 20s, where, you know, the slapstick comedy kings, Harold Lloyd and Buster Keaton, have been really pulling their own weight for action cinema. I mean, the chase scenes that they're putting on is something I'm quite flabbergasted by, actually. They produce chase scenes that are on par with the chase scenes of today, I think. And you gotta remember that they did everything for real back then. So it's very dangerous stuff, and it's all up there on the screen. And yeah, we're just amazed at the quality that they're putting out there.
So if I was listening to you guys speak, and you know, I'm still a little bit hesitant about, oh, do I really want to watch a black and white film? Do I really want to watch, you know, a silent movie? You know, what would be, you know, could you recommend maybe, you know, an action scene from, you know, one of these sort of early films that people should definitely go and check out that you think might, you know, convert people to the merits and the appeal of films from this era?
Yeah, I think we both would say the end scene of Girl Shy from Harold Lloyd. That one is spectacular. It just derails the whole narrative, more or less, and it's let to be really big and propulsive. And he switches vehicles throughout, so he rides motorcycles and cars and stuff, and it's just crazy inventive. And overall, I would say Harold Lloyd's movies are a great way to start, because they are just very snappy and fast-moving and feel more modern. So I think they're an easy way in.
Would you agree with that, Jonas?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, we've been talking on the pod about Harold Lloyd being like action for like maybe the everyman. It's quite easy to get into. The plots are very much in the same veins as they are today. Boy meets girl and quite snappy dialogue. And the comedy, even in written form in these intertitles, is pretty good, actually. We laugh a lot at the intertitles. So, Harold Lloyd does some great stuff. Of course, Buster Keaton has some more elevated stuff that is more ingenuity to it, especially in Sherlock Jr. It has a great chase scene as well, maybe with more crazy stuff in it. Maybe not as good edited and put together as the Harold Lloyd stuff, but I mean, really, really, really good.
Okay, well, some recommendations there for people to go away and investigate. So I think it's time that we got stuck into Man on the Roof. So, as they say in Stockholm, spela trailen.
Vem var Nyman?
Han var en dålig polis.
Fel. Nyman var en in i helvete dålig polis.
Vet man vem den här mannen är som sitter här uppe på taket?
Nej, tyvärr vet inte vem det är. Vi vet bara att det är en galning som sitter där uppe och skjuter på polisen.
Förefaller det vara rationellt?
When a policeman is brutally murdered, two detectives called Beck and Rune are assigned the job of solving the case. As they investigate, they learn that the murdered man, called Newman, was well known among his colleagues for abusing his power and for roughing up suspects and civilians. As Beck and Rune close in on a suspect and learn the disturbing truth behind the killing, their quarry climbs on the roof of the building, along with a selection of automatic rifles, with the goal of killing as many others as he can. I should also give a little more background to the film. It's based on a book, which in turn is part of a famous series of Swedish police procedural novels written by May Hörvall and Per Wöller. So Martin Beck and the other characters in this film first appeared in print in 1965, before this series ended a decade later in 75 with Wöller's death. Over the years, there have been numerous screen adaptations, most notably in Sweden, where the character continues to be played on TV. But there's also been other film adaptations. So Walter Matthau played an Americanized version of Beck in 1973's The Laughing Policeman. And Derek Jacobi, of all people, played him in a film in the early 80s. This film came out in 1976. It has a 7.3 rating on IMDb and an 89% audience rating on Rotten Tomatoes. So I think I've talked enough. So let's hear a little from my guests. So, Jonas, what did you make of Man on the Roof?
Well, this is, of course, one of our great classics here in Sweden. Of course, internationally, everybody talks about Ingmar Bergman, but I would say Bo Widerberg is almost as big, the director behind this movie, here in Sweden at least, and in great part for this movie. Of course, Beck is a big, big franchise here in Sweden, especially these newer Becks that have come out in the 2000s. But I think that almost everybody is agreeing on that The Man on the Roof is the best Beck movie. And this is not part of like a series with the same actors. This is a one-off, you could say. And I really, really like this, actually. I had forgotten about it, hadn't seen it for like 20 years or something like that. But I was pleasantly surprised by how interesting it was in many regards. I mean, it's a handheld camera, very nitty-gritty, very social realistic in many ways. But it's also this quiet sort of humor underlying everything. the two cops, Beck and Rönn, are extremely tired for like the remainder of the movie. And I love it so much. And the guy playing Rönn, Håkan Särner, he got like the Swedish Academy Award for acting for his part. And I really love his portrayal of Rönn. He does some small, minuscule stuff that I get lost in, like the way he closes a door when sitting on a stool. I mean, and the way he collects coffee cups, and he's like sleepwalking in a fantastic way. I really, really love it.
Well, he does actually fall asleep at one point in the film. So, I mean, that's just how tired he is in this movie. But what about you, Anders?
Yeah, I have to agree. It's been maybe 15, 20 years since I saw this last as well. And I remember also, I mean, this is a movie that most Swedes grew up with. And usually I am pretty, I have some trouble with nostalgia and stuff like that. So, but I remember when it was shown on TV early, and they warned about strong violence and stuff before. And this opening scene is really something. I mean, it's almost like a giallo, one of these Italian slasher criminal movies.
Definitely.
Very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, that opening scene is very, very striking. As you say, I thought exactly the same as you, that it did seem like an Italian giallo movie. So you have this this guy, he's lying in a hospital bed. He's the victim of in this particular sequence that's about to sort of come up, and you see somebody observing him from the window, and you can just see this big sort of close up of an eye, and that I think that really gives it that sort of Italian giallo feel. And then what follows is is a very brutal murder with it's an absolute bloodbath in that hospital room. And yeah, it certainly sets up that very, very striking opening. But going back to what Jonas was saying, but then what sort of immediately comes after that is very much almost like a social realistic drama, and it's a very quiet, low-key type of film, very understated, certainly for the first part. And I would agree, there's a lot of subtle characterization that goes on within that part of the film. And this film, it has this sort of quiet, seductive charm, and it's engrossing without really becomes engrossing without you really realizing it. And it was, as I say, a film which, especially on my second viewing, I was like, oh, this is, there's some really good stuff going on here.
And of course, it's really a movie with two different parts. Mm. The first part being the social realistic criminal investigation. And when the going gets tough, I mean, the murderer essentially jumps up on this roof and starts shooting policemen. And this becomes like a thriller / action movie in the same vein as like maybe French Connection, which the director was very keen to replicating in Swedish. He had seen French Connection and thought, oh man, this is some great stuff. I need to do a Swedish film that pays tribute to this movie. It's very intense stuff, the final 40 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think that this film is very much a movie of two halves, and that the first half feels a bit like, certainly what we get in the UK, feels a bit like one of those sort of Sunday evening detective dramas where it's not too, we all know, you've probably got to get to bed early, you've got work on Monday, you don't want anything too sort of hectic, to get your adrenaline pumping, on a Sunday night when you're just sort of meant to be winding down for the week ahead. The first half feels very much in that sort of, Sunday evening detective drama type feel. And then the second half, the film sort of turns into like a Bourne movie. I mean, especially with all of that handheld camera work, which we see in the first half, but it's just really, you know, following the characters as they sort of quietly nod off as they're interrogating a suspect. But then in the second half, it's used much more dynamically for these action sequences. And it's really, really effective. The way in which it really adds to the handheld stuff, really adds to the dynamism of the scene. It really kind of puts you as the viewer into the middle of these situations. And you can kind of feel the confusion that the characters themselves are feeling at that particular moment. So, yeah, it's very striking, the difference between the first half and the second half. But you know, I mean, Anders, did you sort of pick up on the sort of the distinct difference in tone between the, you know, the two halves of this film?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is one of its strong points for me, because how it builds slowly and then becomes something completely different. It just erupts, more or less. I really like this structuring, and I gotta comment on the use of music in this movie.
Yeah.
I think that this Björn Jason Lind's flute music, I think it's flute anyway, is used very well throughout, very sparingly. Or what do you say? It comes and goes, and I've talked about it earlier or in our podcast that I have a problem with music in... I have a complicated relationship to music in film. I often think it's overdone and tries to manipulate you too much. So I think the use here is very, very on point.
Okay.
Well, there was some interesting reviews in the 70s for this movie in Swedish, in Sweden. There were some reviewers that thought he's trying too much to make this an entertaining movie. He should have gone all in for the social criticism. Like, that's the most essential part of a movie in Sweden in the 70s.
The worst thing you can do in Sweden is to make an entertaining movie.
Yeah.
But I guess I haven't read any of the books, but supposedly they are a bit sharper in their critique of Swedish society. And seemingly, I'm not too well versed in this, but seemingly there had been a debate for years on police violence how the police was becoming this state within the state and stuff. So it seems to touch on stuff that were boiling in the Swedish society at the time.
Well, that is one element that I wanted to get into, because it did feel to me as if this film was, you know, trying to make a commentary on Swedish society at the time. So it's really interesting to hear that point that you make. I mean, there did seem to be like an element of playing different generations against each other for me, because you know, all the policemen, or the majority of the policemen that we see in this film, are, you know, they're middle-aged guys, they're tired physically, but they also seem to be like morally quite weary as well. But then we see a lot of certainly at the beginning of the film, we see a lot of young people as well. So we see this protester who's been held in a police cell, and he's complaining about the fact that he's been held there for hours without charge. There's a young guy who has been arrested for like a drugs charge, but he's complaining about the fact that, you know, some guy's been selling like a bad batch of drugs and 17 people are dead and no one in the police is doing anything about it. And we see this rookie cop, you know, he's at the murder scene and he's puking up his guts. And so there seems to be this sort of sense of like a clash between generations. So, and I don't know if that was something that was a sort of a live issue or debate in Sweden, you know, at the time that this film came out.
Well, I do think that a lot of youths were revolutionizing against the older guard, of course, as people were in other parts of the world, of course. It was the 70s, after all. And especially here in Sweden, where we had lots of collectives. I don't know what you would call it in English. But,
no, they're called the same thing here. So people know what you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So a lot of we had a lot of collectives here in Sweden where people gathered in houses, like 10, 20 people. And all of them was of course, very young. And so, of course, that's pretty much on point as well. The police being pointed at for being like this old conservative guard that has been power crazy, and they need to get with the times. Mm. So yeah, definitely was a thing in Sweden in the 70s. And I think Bo Widerberg was keen to capture that vibe as well. And I think he really captures the vibe of the Swedish society very well. That's one of the key strengths of the movie, I think. For one thing, I mean, the coffee drinking is out of control in this movie. You know, coffee and cakes everywhere. I mean, Beck gets offered coffee and cakes wherever he goes. He like has a small stakeout on the man on the roof at the end of the movie, and an old lady is serving him coffee. And at the same time, you can see the man on the roof. He has a thermos with coffee with him, and he dips sugar cubes into the coffee and has like a fika on the roof while waiting for more cops to kill. So yeah, that is so very, very Swedish.
Yeah, I was gonna say something about that too. I mean, yeah, it really captures the Swede. When I worked in a cemetery some years back, I worked with elder guys, and I mean, we were very tired, and we drank lots of coffee, and I mean, we were sitting talking about coffee more or less. Yeah, so it's on point.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
Well, there have been lots of different adaptations of this character, as we've already sort of mentioned. And I just wondered, you know, if you guys could sort of say, you know, how you felt that this one, you know, measures up against the others that have been out there. I mean, Jonas, you've already said that this one, the kind of general regard is that this is the best version of the Beck character that we get. I mean, are there other sort of notable ones? Have there been has it been a kind of particular disastrous version of this character that has come out?
Well, I've not seen every single version of these. I mean, I haven't seen the English versions. I would love to see the Walter Matthau version. I have a very hard time picturing Walter Matthau doing a detective, but maybe I'm just hardwired the wrong way here. Yeah, so Carl Gustav Lindstedt, who did Beck here, he was like a comedian in Sweden before this movie. And so everybody was like, oh man, that is definitely the wrong choice for doing Beck. I mean, what is Bo Widerberg thinking? But I have to say he's great as Beck. Very tired, very on point as the character. But later on, Gösta Ekman became Beck in the 80s and 90s, and he was a comedian as well. So it was like a theme going on. And later on, Peter Haber took care of the character when it became this big franchise in the 2000s. And I have no idea how many movies he's done, perhaps 30 or something. It's crazy. So I think if you ask the general Swede people about Beck, they would probably say Peter Haber is their favorite because they've probably seen that Beck. Yeah. He is about as Swedish as cinnamon buns, you know. So that Beck character is ubiquitous with you know, the actor is ubiquitous with Beck.
Yep.
But in my mind, it's Carl Gustav Lindstedt who is the real Beck.
I haven't seen one of those Peter Haber movies. I think they go for a more darker, grittier tone or something, more like those Morgan Freeman thrillers. This is my presumption, at least. But I think it's a generational thing as well. A younger generation than us were probably watching these with their family. That was like a family gathering thing, and watch a Beck movie, like those Sunday detective stories you were talking about, Winding Down or something, a bit. So this is my Beck as well. But as I said, I grew up with the Gösta Ekman movies. They were when I was at the ripe age, but I think this movie stands out anyway. I really like the structuring and that they are tired and they are not these hero type characters at all.
No.
I mean, as soon in the end when they are trying to do things on their own, they just mess up a lot.
Yeah, they do some catastrophic choices in the last part of the movie. Yeah, so they don't really cast a great shine on the police force in this movie.
I mean, suddenly out of thin air, Martin Beck is going to go Dirty Harry on
this. Yeah, he turns into Charles Bronson at the end of this movie.
Yeah, for no apparent reason. And he is shot immediately.
Yeah,
that's not the Swedish way.
I like that he, before launching his one-man commando raid on the man on the roof, I like the fact that he put on a woolly hat to sort of signify, okay, now I'm in battle mode or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was that ending, though. I did want to ask you guys, as I've got you here, you know, at the very ending here, and, you know, this is a major spoiler. I mean, we're talking about a film that's nearly 50 years old. I don't worry about spoilers too much here, but right at the very end of this film, you know, we see a couple of policemen and a building construction worker who's basically just volunteered to sort of try and get this guy on the roof. And it's this member of the public who ends up shooting the guy who's been behind all these murders. And I was a little bit, what do you think lay behind that particular choice? I mean, it feels like very deliberate that it's not a member of the police who ultimately is responsible for stopping this sniper. And I just wondered, you know, how you read that particular moment and choice.
I think definitely Bo Widerberg has a point to make there. I'm not sure that he's like overtly critical of the police force in general, but as for the theme of the movie, it's pretty much that police are useless. That's the feeling I get, that they can't do anything right, basically. And so we have to take the law into our own hands. But it is this crazy cop that enlists this guy, Gunvald Larsson. And he has become this very iconic character as well in the later Beck, with Mikael Persbrandt playing the character in later days. So he is almost as iconic as Beck himself. And he's much more of a loose cannon, Dirty Harry style cop. And so nobody's really surprised that he's like out of the blue enlists a civilian like, oh, you have a gun. Well, follow us then and help out. That's like, what? Well, yes, yeah. It's Gunvald. He calls his captain Heil Hitler and stuff like that. So that's just a basic fare with him. And the thing is, they don't really reprimand him or anything, Gunvald Larsson. He's like just, he's crazy, but he's very good at his job, so let him do what he wants. So he wants to enlist civilians? Yeah, sure, why not? But I think it's very funny that the ending line of the movie, when the civilian has shot, he doesn't shoot him dead, he just injures the man on the roof. And Gunvald runs up and kicks away the gun. And then Gunvald turns to the civilian and says, do you have a license for that gun? Well, no. Well, then it's going to be trouble for you then. And, I mean, it just turns on me instantly. That's so funny. So many weird, funny things in this movie. I'm not sure if Bo Widerberg was really critical of the police force, but The tone and the theme of this movie is that cops are very tired. They're trying to do their work, but they're not that good at it.
So before we wrap up this part of the podcast, has anyone got any final thoughts on Man on the Roof?
I just remember I should have mentioned that a lot of the casting in the smaller parts are real policemen and journalists and stuff. And some of the line reading from some smaller characters that come in are really odd. So it really shows that it's not an actor. I mean, they come in and are so stiff.
And
I mean, it's really weird. Basically a Michael Mann movie. I mean, he usually do this too, cast real policemen and stuff.
It's a Michael Mann
and
movie.
On that, on that note, I mean, it is a bit like Miami Vice. It just ends when it when the guy is caught. It just ends, and we are left. We don't even know what happens to Beck. Yeah. It's a bit like Miami Vice, where you just are in the movie for a while, and then you leave that universe, and nothing is really resolved or anything.
And in the same time, I think it's a bit like Hot Fuzz as well, because when they come to the police station, I mean, the police station looked exactly like the police station in Hot Fuzz. I mean, it was so bare-boned, and it almost looked like it was a set that they didn't really mind that much about, but I read it was actually a real police station that they filmed at, so... Man, Swedish police stations back in the day, they were really lackluster.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
Woohoo!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at ThatMomentIn.com. I am your host, Laverne, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, we'll be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we are going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So, listen to the Cinema Recall Podcast on the site ThatMomentIn.com, or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy it.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This takes place right at the end of the film. The man is on the roof, and he's taking pot shots at any law enforcement officials he can see. The police bring in a couple of helicopters to try and take out the man on the roof, but he opens fire on the aircraft. The damaged Whirlybird ends up making a crash landing in a public square. As the pilot and passengers scramble out, they yell a warning about the fuel tank being about to blow. And once everyone's clear, sure enough, there's an explosion of sorts. Gents, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
Yeah, at first when you proposed us to be in here, me and Jonas talked about it would be fun to do a Swedish movie, and we both talked about The Man on the Roof, but we were both like, did the helicopter explode? Memory didn't serve us. Right, so we scanned the movie, and at first I was like, nah, it didn't explode. I just checked in a little bit, because it just crashes on this men's toilet at first. but it does explode.
Yeah.
At first I was like, I have to scan through all Swedish action thriller legend Mats Helge Olsson's movies to find an exploding helicopter, but... I mean, he just cheese around. There are helicopters present, but I don't think he ever could afford to blow one up. So it is the man on the roof that explodes a helicopter.
Yeah, and it's not really a working helicopter. They have a helicopter carcass that they are positioning on a crane and drops onto the men's bathroom. So there's some crafty editing being done here, but I do think the editing is quite nice. And Bo Widerberg himself took the camera to film from below the men's toilet, where you can see the helicopter crashing down onto it, because everybody deemed it to be too dangerous to film from that angle. So he took the camera himself.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think that shot definitely, is quite an interesting shot for this type of movie, because quite clearly the cameraman's putting himself in a bit of peril. And we see a lot of this type of shot where the helicopter wreckage is coming directly towards the camera. But generally in films now, we know that that's probably a CGI creation. So, nobody's in any particular danger here. But yeah, here we see a massive, great helicopter carcass, the fuselage of it coming crashing down into this public square. And it's, for a few seconds, it's coming, straight towards the camera. And it really makes for a cool shot. And picking up on Anders' point, I think this one is a bit of a borderline exploding helicopter. I mean, it crashes, everyone scrambles free, and then it does, well, there is an explosion, and the helicopter is now completely, I mean, no one's going to be repairing this aircraft after this. But, you know, there is, it's on fire and there is a burst of flames. But I would put this as a very, it just sneaks over the line as being an exploding helicopter. I'm assuming you guys had a similar thoughts on what you saw here.
It's the Swedish way.
yeah, definitely. You know, we don't want to blow anything up in the air. That would be too dangerous. So let's take it down to the ground first, clear everybody, and then we can do a bit of fire around it. But this is still one of the most iconic, most dangerous, most biggest crowds for an action scene in Sweden to this day. They filmed this on the Long Friday in Easter. So they have like 3,000 people in Odenplan where the helicopter crashes, which is a big square in Sweden. And it's pretty spectacular when you see the helicopter at least going down. The man on the roof has shot the helicopter down, and we get some nice shots at it almost passing buildings, and I read that they had window dummies so that they could position the windows just next to the helicopter in air so as not to endanger any houses or stuff like that. So a bit of ingenuity going on here. And it's not the greatest exploding helicopter, of course, of course. But nonetheless, as a Swede, I do tend to think I'm pretty proud of this, actually. My sister's boyfriend was one of the crowd here, one of the people in the crowd.
Fantastic.
And I think a lot of Swedes at least know someone who was in that crowd. So it's almost like, you had to be there it was a big thing and stuff like that. So it's legend these days in Sweden, that helicopter crashing.
Yeah. A helicopter fizzling out is our proudest action moment.
Yeah.
But extra point I would want to point out is that the helicopters do feature very prominently on the posters for this movie. Mm. And it's a very cool poster design with a sort of very dramatic sort of angled shot looking up at these two helicopters above. And great to I always love seeing helicopters feature prominently in the artwork for any movie. And the poster for Man on the Roof is really cool, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, there is some helicopter action before the helicopter crashing. There's like two helicopters in the air, and they, as we've alluded to, they're trying to put down SWAT team members on the roof with the helicopters. But I mean, the man on the roof just shoots the guy in the air being propelled down onto the roof, and he shoots on the helicopters and stuff like that.
Okay. All right, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Anders, Jonas, thank you very much for joining me. Would one of you like to tell people where they can find your excellent podcast?
We're at all the usual places, of course. Podcaster app, and search for PodHard on Twitter and on Instagram and Facebook. And you can find us on, we have a web page on Podbean/PodHard. So, come check us out and we'll take you for a ride through cinema history.
Well, I would really urge you to go and do that because, I think it's a great podcast that you guys have been putting together. So, big recommendation from me. As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website, explodinghelicopter.com. And if you can see it in your cold, dead heart to give us to rate, review or retweet us, we'd be very grateful. More people need to hear what we do. The pain shouldn't be all yours. We'll be back soon, but until then, keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Oh, actually, before we get started, could you, the authors of the series of books this film is based on, how do you pronounce their names?
Well, it is Maj Sjöwall och Per Wahlöö.
Per Wahlöö.
Yeah, it's the Ö sound. It really gets English-speaking people I've heard before. Maj Sjöwall, Per Wahlöö.
You have to... Maj...
Maj.
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 Yep.
Sjöwall.
Sjöwall.
That's pretty good. Per Wahlöö.
Per Wahlöö.
I'm sure you'll do great.
Yeah, that'll have to do for